This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is Longer Telomeres for Longer Lifespans. Many factors have contributed to Americans' rising life expectancy, currently at 78 years. For almost 50 years, however, scientists have known about the Hayflick limit, that most human cells are programmed to only divide about 50 times, setting a biological lifespan limit of about 120 years. Researchers believe this is due to the telomeres at the ends of our chromosomes often becoming shorter when cells divide. In his just-published book, The Immortality Edge, Dr. Michael Fossil shares his decades of telomere research and shares his knowledge on how to enhance your health and your life expectancy by helping your telomeres thrive. Dr. Fossil, welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
The jacket of the Immortality Edge uses the metaphor of our chromosomes' telomeres being like the plastic caps on the ends of our shoelaces. Can you elaborate on that metaphor?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting metaphor. It's very tangible. It's inaccurate in some ways, but like most tangible metaphors, it makes it very useful if you can get a feel for them. That's one of those odd words no one's ever heard of before, aglet. Aglet turns out to be the name of that little plastic thing on the end of shoelaces. Mm-hmm. Not that most of us have shoelaces these days. In the case of shoelaces, it's meant to keep the shoelace from unraveling. In the case of telomeres and chromosomes, it's not really to keep them unraveling, but it acts as a sort of a clock that is a major factor in determining how your genes get expressed. So let me clarify this a little bit. We used to think, if I go back, well, I don't know, almost 100 years, people used to think that the major difference between, say, a skin cell and a brain cell was that they had different genes. And we know that's not true. They have the same genes. They just express them differently. Well, in the same sense, there are still people who feel that the major difference between a young cell and an old cell is that somehow the genes have been damaged or are different genes. And that's, largely speaking, not at all true. The major difference between a young cell and an old cell is the pattern of gene expression. So it appears to be that one major point that controls that is a telomere. Now, I look at this more practically. I'm not interested in sort of what causes aging or causes telomere shortening. I think a more practical question is, how can we intervene? It's like if somebody comes to me for an illness, they're not really looking for a philosophical discussion about the illness. They want to know if we can fix it. I think that's the question here. When we look at telomeres, the question isn't, do they cause aging? Because in many respects, the answer is no, of course they don't. The question is, where can we intervene? And I think of all the things we can do, whether it's diet or meditation or otherwise, probably ultimately the most effective place to intervene is a telomere. In the meantime, what can you do at home? And that's a different question.
What exactly is in the telomeres?
Well, the telomere at first sight probably looks like any other portion of the chromosome. The difference is that instead of coding information, it tends to be a kind of a clock. It's a repeating sequence of six different bases. And the length of that set of bases, thousands of bases, determines the pattern of gene expression, not only just below the telomere, but to a large degree probably elsewhere throughout the chromosome. Example, as I get older, I'm less and less apt to repair and replace broken parts of cells. And the reason is that the rate of repair and replacement turns down as we get older, and the reason that occurs is that the telomere gets shorter. So again, it's that shortened part of the end of the telomere, which by itself doesn't look very interesting, but as it shortens, it changes the rate in which you do things. And that turns out to be absolutely critical. It's what determines whether you're old or young.
When we talk about genes being turned on and off, let's say we make changes in our diet and it turns on a gene, is it the telomeres that send the signal to turn on that gene?
Not really. You raise an interesting point. Everything you do affects gene expression. If I eat a carrot, it changes my gene expression. If I say hello in the morning, it probably changes my gene expression. Everything has an impact on gene expression somewhere. The question is which ones and how much. The telomeres are only one influence among many. But again, they turn out to be a critical influence when you're looking at aging. And the important thing that happens, I suppose I could break this down, two general sorts of things inside yourself, things that you just continually replace and recycle, and things that you actually repair. The only part of your cell that you actually repair chemically are your genes. Everything else your body doesn't bother repairing, it just replaces. So let's take an example. Let's say that my house, every couple of years I go out and I repaint it, whether it needs it or not. I don't so much repair it as I just strip off the old paint, put on new paint. That's the kind of thing going on in your cells. If we look at a particular cell, let's say we look at a part of your cell like a protein. All right, here's a particular protein in your cell that's important for you. If I found, say 100,000 molecules of that protein inside your cell, some of them are damaged, some of them aren't. Anytime I look, there's a certain percentage of them that just don't work. They're made badly or they've gotten damaged. Your body doesn't go in and replace the damaged protein. It just isn't always tearing down proteins and building up proteins. So there's this continual recycling throughout your cells. As you get older, that recycling rate slows down. So on the average, even though the rate of damage doesn't increase, what happens is, anytime I go looking, there's a higher percentage of damage. So again, as I get older, maybe I've only got 2% of cells, 2% of proteins that look bad or don't work when I'm young. But that may be 20% when I get older. The outcome is the cell doesn't work as a whole because it's not recycling as fast. It's the rate of recycling that is critical here. And again, that seems to be set by telomeres.
You reported on research that found that not only are shorter telomeres associated with shorter life expectancy, but also a lot of health problems.
Yes. In an overall way, it's probably true that the length of your telomeres is associated with the length of your life, in an overall way. Not always. Obviously, if I'm an 18-year-old kid who's gotten drunk and I'm going 80 miles an hour down the highway, hit a cement embankment, the least important part is what my telomere lengths are. I've got bigger problems. So again, telomeres affect lifespan, but only in a general way. In some certain diseases, for example, some of the early aging syndromes, that appears to be what sets the clock. So we have progeric kids who at age 5 look like they're 80 years old in some respects. They have short telomeres, and that seems to be the limiting factor for them. There are other parts that play a role in it, but the clock setting is the telomere. However, for you and I and everyone else, for most of us out in the world, the things that worry us as we get older are things like strokes, heart attacks, Alzheimer's disease, osteoarthritis, and so on. And it looks like all of those things are also controlled in a timing sense by the telomere. I'm not saying that telomeres are the only thing that, for example, causes heart disease. Clearly, cholesterol plays a role, high blood pressure plays a role, sugar plays a role, stress plays a role, smoking plays a role. But if I look at those progeric kids who get heart disease, they don't have any of the normal risk factors, and yet they have heart disease, and it's the telomeres that play it. It looks like if I'm looking for a single effective point of intervention, the best place is not to lower your cholesterol. It's probably to reset your telomeres. We're not very good at that, so we tend to tell patients we need to get your cholesterol down, your blood pressure, your stress, your sugar, and your smoking. But it'd probably be much more effective as a point of intervention to just reset telomeres.
What role does the telomerase play?
Yeah, telomerase is the enzyme that resets the clock. If the telomere is a clock, telomerase rewinds it. It's interesting that you ask, because a lot of us think aging just occurs. You know, things just wear out. And that's not at all the case, because there are lots of types of cells and organisms that don't show any aging in that sense at all. In a very real biological sense, everyone who's listening, you and I specifically, are several billion years old. Because the cells that we have in our bodies derive from cells that derive from cells that derive from cells that have been around that long. That line of cells, the germ cell line, has never aged. So when you want to talk about aging, it's interesting to note that it doesn't always occur. Some cells don't age, some cells do age. It turns out that the cells that don't age express telomerase and reset the clock. So the question that we want to ask is, can we use telomerase to reset the clock when we want to? Example. Could I use telomerase or something like that to reset the clock in your knees so that rather than replace your knee joint, what if I could just have your body rebuild the knee joint the way it's doing every day, day to day, hour by hour, when you're 20, but that rate of repair and replacement slows down when you're 60? Can we reset that? Probably we can, using telomerase.
And at this point, you've done that in the lab?
Not myself, no, but yes. There are probably three ways to do this. One would be just to take telomerase and put it in the body. The problem with that is it doesn't last long in the bloodstream. It has a half-life in the order of seconds. It's a very fragile molecule. And the second question is, can you get it into cells, which is where you need it? You don't need it in the bloodstream. And there was one group that tried that a few years ago. That company went bankrupt, but they had some thoughts they could get it into cells. So that's one possibility. The second possibility that's a little bit more elegant would be to put in a new telomerase gene. There are actually two genes involved, but the one that's important is called HTERT. But if you could put in a new gene, then you could have telomerase turned on, and that's been done. The third way that's much more elegant would be just to turn on and off the gene you've got. We know that's doable for several reasons. We know that there are certain blood cells in your marrow, certain early stem cells in your marrow, that do turn it on and off. But we know it's doable. The question is, can we control it? And the answer is just about yes. We've seen some evidence that we can, even in clinical human studies, early evidence, but yes.
And in the body, we see a kind of a continuum of it in that somatic cells have practically no telomerase turned on, and then we have stem cells that have some, reproductive cells that have even more, and cancer cells that have too much.
That's right. There is a spectrum. And at the one extreme of the embryonic stem cells, then you have the stem cells that may not be embryonic, but they're pretty early and pretty much capable of many things. Then you have other cells that are sort of mother cells for certain cell lines, like red blood cells. And then you had, as you said, somatic cells, typical cell. I pull off a piece of my skin or a muscle cell or any other cell, and most of them never express telomerase. So there is that spectrum. And the big, you know, the 500-pound gorilla that people ignore or worry about, and maybe they shouldn't, but it comes up all the time, is the cancer cell. You know, cancer cells have, there are three obstacles to cancer within your cells and at least two externally to cells. But within cells, one of them is gene repair. If I repair my genes, I can avoid most cancers. There are exceptions to that, too. The second thing is what's called the cell cycle breaking system. It just means if the cell detects there's still a problem with the chromosome, still a DNA damage, it doesn't let the cell divide, which is very handy. But if it does divide, then you've got the third mechanism, which is the telomerase. And the idea is that if my cells are cancerous, that's fine, let them age themselves to death, which is probably why you and I age in some deep philosophical sense, teleologic sense. But what's interesting is that most cells, most cancer cells, have to express telomerase to keep dividing. And so we might worry, we might reasonably say, oh my God, if we use telomerase, will we cause cancer? Reasonable concern, but so far the data suggests otherwise. Because, it looks like the reason is because if we have telomerase and have long telomeres, you repair the DNA better so that the genes are more stable. So the bottom line seems to be there's actually less risk of cancer with telomerase rather than more risk. Well, I don't mean to slide this worry under the rug. It's still a very real worry. But so far the data suggests that that worry is not all that well-founded. It's probably part of the reason why you see the cancer rate go up in older people rather than young people. Certainly young people get cancers, but there are far many of them in older people, not simply because we've been around longer, but because we don't take care of our genes. We don't repair them as well as we should, hence telomerase.
With current interventions, it's primarily oriented toward keeping the telomeres from getting shorter, but in the lab you've actually had some telomeres get longer.
Yeah, you hit it on the head. With the exception of some of the therapies we're going to talk about, the really interesting stuff, up until now, the only thing you really could have done for this would be slow the rate of telomere loss. And when you think about it culturally, that's in some sense exactly what we've done so far. If you and I look back at pictures of our grandparents or our great-grandparents and so forth, and you know their ages, many of us are struck by how old these people look at what we think of as a young age. So I'll see a 50-year-old person, a 50-year-old man, say, back in 1700s, who looks to me like they're 100 years old, compared to a 50-year-old these days who looks relatively young and healthy. Well, the reason probably is largely that we have better food, less stress, less hard work, less of a lot of things, better hygiene. In short, there's less stress in the body, so the telomeres don't shorten as fast. The classic good example of this is skin aging. If I'm exposed to the sun, a lot of wind, a lot of weathering, but particularly sun, the skin will age faster than it will on unprotected parts of my body, such as my buttock. Buttock skin tends to not age very fast because it's pretty much protected. About all you do is sit on it. But the same is true in general of the body. The more I stress my immune system, the more I stress my vascular system, the faster it ages on the average. Again, that's why people 200 years ago tended to look older for their age than we do. So what can we do these days? And the answer is the same sort of thing. We can lower stress, we can have a better diet, we can have appropriate exercise, lots of things like that we can hope to do to slow the aging process. That does not reverse it. Whereas what most of us are working on now is the idea of actually reversing this. Never mind slowing it, let's reverse it. Let's take an analogy. If I go back in 1950, most parents were worried about polio. Well, there were two things you could do. You could either avoid getting it, which is what we're talking about with aging now, or you could try to cure it. And in 1954, along came the yearly shot vaccine. And that was much more impressive, much more useful than simply avoiding contact in public swimming pools and so forth. So both of those are important to us right now. We want to slow the aging process, which is what everybody who's listening can do, but we'd also like to do something much more dramatic, which is reverse it, prevent disease, cure disease.
You also touched on something I like to emphasize. When people think of somebody, say, 70 years old, they think back to how their parents or grandparents were at that age, and that's their image of 70. And you get all these baby boomers saying, but I feel 20, 30 years younger. You should. You know, you want your reference to be where we're headed, not how our parents or grandparents aged.
That's absolutely right. You know, the another analogy it reminds me of, Michael, you and I both have a psychology background. And if I go back to the 60s and 70s, 1960s, 1970s, there was a common saying back then that psychiatry is something you do while you're waiting for the biochemist to arrive. And I don't think that was accurate in a lot of ways, but I understand the point they were making. They were saying, we have a lot of talking therapy, they would call it, but if we could understand the biochemical mechanisms, we could actually cure psychiatric disease. Well, never mind whether that's true or not. That doesn't concern me. But I understand the analogy, and I think that the analogy fits here. We may not be able to actually cure aging at the moment for most of us, but we can certainly try to use other therapies to deal with what we have, lower the stress, for example. Again, I don't mean to stress that analogy. It's a poor one in many ways, but it sounds familiar.
We all want a magic bullet, and it's being healthy and living long is really a multi-process thing. The weakest link is what's going to do you in.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right.
We would all love to just go to our doctor's office and have them do a easy test and tell us how our telomeres are doing. But you're saying at this point that's not real practical for the layman.
Actually, there are two or three companies I know right now who are trying to develop simple tests that lay people could use to test telomere length. I've seen none of these come onto the market yet, but there's been some interest in doing it. Still, you're right. More than that, most of us would like to be able to go to somebody and reset our telomeres. Let me point out a couple of things. One is, we're not just talking about extending a lifespan, but the healthy lifespan. None of us have any interest in spending 50 years in the nursing home with Alzheimer's, but that's not at all what we're talking about. We're talking about having the physiology, the health, the energy that you had when you were 20 or 30, and the expectation for a healthy life. The other thing is that the therapies we've got now, such as they are out there, are not proven. In the lab, we've got things proven. You know, we know we can do certain things in the lab, but being able to do that to people right now is just right on the edge. There are some therapies that appear to work, the data is early, but that's not surprising in many ways. You know, it takes most of us decades to age. It will probably take years to unage in some sense. This is not going to be a matter of getting a pill and the next day you wake up and you're 20. No, to the contrary, it's going to take a while before your body repairs itself.
In the meantime, the Immortality Edge has a paper and pencil test that gives you kind of a rough idea of how your telomeres are doing.
I think a rough idea is right. And even if I can actually measure them using biochemical methods, the measures aren't all that good. They may be measuring the wrong set of cells. They may be measuring the average, not the shortest. So it's a new field, and the paper and pencil test may help you a bit. But again, it's not the absolute answer by any means. It's the best you can do for now.
There's one company that has a supplement that appears to help some. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes. The only company right now that has any data to support this kind of claim is a company called TA Sciences in New York. And what they've got is, basically it's a nutraceutical. It's an interesting historical story about how it occurred. They took up an option on using a compound that turns out to have been in human use for thousands of years, extracted it, purified it, and again, we know in the lab it can be used to reset telomere lengths. In human beings, it appears to do the same thing so far. Now, since it's a nutraceutical, they can't make any disease claims. They can't, for example, say that it would cure heart disease or cure osteoarthritis. What they can say legally and I think appropriately is that, you know, it may reset aging or it may make you feel better. They can make lots of non-disease claims. So far, the early data suggests that they're right. If we look at some immune function, if we look at certain other measures that the company has taken of people who are on this, it looks like that we're showing early reversal of aging. But again, it's early still. We'll see what happens.
And at least currently, it's very expensive.
Yeah. Initially, when it came out now about 4 years ago, it was running at about $25,000 a year. And not only was that a lot of money, but it was a lot of money for something that you weren't sure worked. Now the data is a little better that it works, and the price has been coming down. I can't remember where the current price is, but you're looking at something in the order of $5,000 rather than $25,000. We'd have to go on the website and see what the current costs are. Also, they're offering different dosing. Obviously, if I'm 20 years old, I would want none or very little of this. If I'm 40 years old, I might want more. If I'm 60, I might want more. If I'm 80, I might want to quickly get it before I die. I think that's the psychological thinking that's going on in people's minds. For whatever reason, they're offering different doses. And again, that's probably appropriate.
And is the cost on that to recoup the research cost, or is it very expensive to produce?
It's not so much the research cost. That's part of it. Again, you know, they're paying the company who owns the intellectual property rights on this, Geron Corporation, California. They're paying them as well. There's also the cost of extracting it. But interestingly enough, a lot of the initial cost was used to defray the research expenses. So the man who runs the company, Noel Patton, was requiring that people who took this TA65 compound to undergo a series of tests, and those were biochemical tests, they were lab tests, they were typical physical examination tests, for example, range of motion of knees, ability to distinguish visual contrast, blood pressure, immune function, a lot of fairly reasonable tests. The tests we would like to have seen most importantly are tests we really can't do. We'd like to see telomere lengths and biopsies of your coronary arteries, and likewise your brain. Not going to happen. But the tests that were doable, he required of people who were taking it. So what he was doing is making an investment in the research, trying to find out whether the compound worked, which was good of him. Again, it meant that the people who were doing this were people who had the money to do it, but the outcome was that we began to get data that suggested it actually works. So my hat's off to Noel.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Fossil, who is professor at Michigan State University and the founding editor of the Journal of Anti-Aging Medicine.
Now called Rejuvenation Research, right?
And you're the principal author of The Immortality Edge. The website is michaelfossil.com. That's michaelfossil.com. And you must really love school. You have both an MD and a PhD.
I had a lot of fun doing it, and people were silly enough to let me keep doing it and pay for it. So.
And the book just became available in December. It has a copyright of 2011. Have there been any developments since the book came out?
No, all of this has been sort of incremental. You know, my first book about this was back in 1996, and then there was a textbook I wrote for Oxford Press back in 2004. And if you track backwards, if I look, for example, back in 1996, my suggestion was that sometime between 10 and 20 years after that, we would have a commercially available compound. That turns out to have been right on the money. But it's been a slow process. There was an interest back now about 10 years ago. There was a couple that came to me and offered me a large amount of money to take all of this work to translational research, that is to take it from the lab to human studies. And the offer fell apart after 6 months. That would have hurried it along. But incrementally, the work has been moving along, partly because of Geron doing work on embryonic stem cells, cancer, and aging-related disease, partly because of companies like Sierra Sciences that have been looking for stronger and more effective and less toxic compounds to use as telomerase activators, largely because of people like Noel Patton who have been willing to take a risk and go out and try this and see what they can do with it, and a number of other small companies as well as research labs throughout the world. It's been interesting to me in a sociologic sense. If I go back 20 years and ask people what caused aging, you've got answers that went all over the landscape. Now if I ask older researchers what causes aging, you still get answers all over the research, all over the landscape. But if I go to, for example, young medical students, and I say to them, what causes aging? The next 5 minutes is occupied by a discussion of cell senescence and telomeres. It suggests that the whole concept is sort of coming of age. It's not that, as I say, telomeres and cell senescence cause aging, but they are really a key component of it, and they seem to be the point where we can most effectively intervene. If I talk about age, you know, glycolation products or mitochondrial damage, there are lots of things I can talk about that have a role to play in aging. But all of those things seem to be hard to intervene in. If I find that I get older and I have mitochondrial damage or I accumulate some DNA damage, what do I do about it? Got me. On the other hand, if I'm talking about telomeres, we're looking at something that I can actually affect. So it's a much more practical way of looking at aging. As I say, as a physician, I'm less interested in the philosophy of what causes aging than I am in the question of what can I do about it? Can I fix things? Can I make your osteoarthritis go away? Can I fix somebody's Alzheimer's disease? Can I prevent the heart attack? That's a much more important question.
There are a lot of books on anti-aging, and what you typically get is, here's what you should eat, and here's how you should exercise, and some other things you should do to live longer and healthier. Your book is unique in that your perspective is, what are practical things I can do now that are going to help my telomeres? And the first place you started was with supplements, and you said get a darn good multivitamin, get some fish oil. Then your next three recommendations were supplements that a lot of people probably aren't very familiar with, starting with acetyl L-carnitine. Can you tell us about that?
I have to preface this by saying I think we need to take this all with a grain of salt. Okay. I say that sort of humorously because of what we think of salt these days. But I mean this in a couple of ways. One is, if I go back, I've got a couple of nice quotes from 1898. In 1898, people were just beginning to understand how cells work, and one of the observations they made was that simple sugars are basically the gasoline, the fuel of cells, just sort of one level up from what's called ATP. And there are other things your cells can burn, but simple sugars were the main fuel source for cells. And there were medical scientists in those days, predominantly German and American, because that's where a lot of the research was in those days, who were seriously, honestly saying, and now I'm quoting, sugar is nature's, quote, perfect food, unquote, and we shouldn't eat anything else but sugars. Everything else is a waste of time. Well, we look back at that, either find that humorous or we're horrified that people could honestly recommend that you eat nothing but sugar. But I can't help wondering, as I see all the recommendations that we make, how much of that is ignorance. I can't help thinking that 100 years from now we'll look back and look at some of the recommendations we make, including some of those in my own book, and we'll be horrified by how naive we all were. So any recommendation we make, I think we need to take with a grain of salt. We have to look at it and say, this is our best guess so far, but 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now, we may well have very different ideas. So please, I would urge people to be careful. I see some people who get so stressed about what they eat that I don't care what they eat. They just ruin their entire body by getting so stressed about it. They take this as a religion, not a science. It becomes a matter of faith. I think we need to continually reevaluate and say, well, does this make sense? For example, fish oil. If you look at the data on fish oil, or on particularly things like tocopherols, it comes and goes over the years. There was a point now about 10 years ago where we honestly thought that vitamin E could stave off Alzheimer's disease for as much as 6 to 12 months. Not much, but very useful. Now, the data didn't hold up very well. But you see what I mean? These things come and go. So I think that the recommendations that we've made in that book, a lot of them came from Dave Wolanowski and from Greta Blackburn rather than me, but they represent our best thoughts. They should not be taken as a religion. It's not that. It's your best guess so far.
And in some ways, it's kind of courageous to do that. You put things in print knowing that you may be embarrassed by them 5 or 10 years later.
Well, you have a choice. You can either say nothing, which doesn't help very much, or you can do the best you can. Actually, back to this vitamin E, that's a good example of that. There was an American Aging Association. I used to be their executive director. And back 10 years ago, the early data on vitamin E, there were epidemiologists who said, well, we cannot recommend that people take vitamin E because we don't know that it works. So we should recommend they don't take it. Well, there are a couple of problems with that. One is, what else can you do for Alzheimer's? Nothing. Second is, what are the side effects if you take vitamin E? Well, it's a surprisingly non-toxic compound. About the only side effect that's significant with vitamin E, besides the fact that it costs too much, is that it makes it so the blood doesn't clot as well. Well, that's actually a benefit if you're looking at things like strokes. Also, if I'm saying that you should not take vitamin E, that's equivalent to me saying I know that it doesn't work, which was not true then either. So if I were a sensible physician back in those days, and again, the recommendations have changed, I would have said, listen, our best guess is that you should take vitamin E. The data is not very good, but at today's date, given what we know, probably the best guess, taking the risk and the benefit, is you should take vitamin E. Not because I know it works, but because that's the best I can offer you. Now, again, the recommendations changed 6 months later and the data got a little clarification. But I think that's where we always are. We're making our best guess. So when we recommend diet, we recommend exercise, we recommend meditation, it's not because we're positive. Because given what we know right now, that's the best we can do. And were I to say, we don't know, and therefore you shouldn't do it, that would be hubris. That would be irrational. That would not be appropriate. You make your best guess. You do the best you can. You don't back off and say, well, I don't know, therefore I don't do anything.
And I think what you've done is very helpful, because you catch the news or the magazine articles and they'll say, oh, vitamin E doesn't work, and then you'll check some other sources and they'll say, well, you didn't use the right kind of vitamin E, mm-hmm. or it wasn't the right dosage, and right. It's hard to know what to make of research. And I feel more confident when somebody has really studied the whole picture holistically and said, you know, at this point in time, this is what appears to be the best mix of what to take.
I think you're right. You know, there's not only a matter of the knowledge you've got, but the perspective that you take. An example is, in medicine, a lot of us used to laugh when we get new residents, and we just hire some new resident, they become a new attending, they'd read the latest article that week from the New England Journal of Medicine, and they'd say, we've got to change everything we do. Here's the data that shows that this is what works and this is what doesn't. And we'd sort of laugh because over the past 10 years, we'd seen somebody claim that in the past, and then they proved it didn't work, then it did, and then it didn't. And here was this brand new physician claiming it worked on the basis of one article. Well, they might be right, but they might be wrong. And the perspective was limited. The knowledge was reasonable. The data may have been good. But you know what? I'm looking at it in a broader perspective. It's like my comment about, you know, sugar being nature's perfect food 100 years ago. At the time, that was their best guess. In retrospect, it looks pretty stupid. I think we've got to keep that same sort of perspective and say, well, this is our best guess. But you know what? It's all it is our best guess given our perspective, given our experience, given the data we've got, and it's not perfect. So again, don't take it as a religion. Just because, you know, these days Paleolithic diet is very much in vogue, and probably reasonably, but I don't know that that works. Or look at exercise. For all that people claim otherwise, most of the exercise studies are confounded. What they show is that people who exercise tend to be healthier. Well, maybe that's because healthier people exercise. Again, exercise studies try to get around that and look at things more carefully and show that if you do exercise, it makes for better health. But that's a difficult thing to prove. And I think what we can reasonably say is that for a number of kinds of exercise and for certain sorts of problems, exercise is probably a good thing. But, you know, don't take it as a religion. This is not coming down stone tablets. This is human. We're doing the best we can. Even with regard to exercise, you know, if I look at that impact-related exercise, for example, basketball, mm-hmm. jumping up and down. That turns out to have a good effects on vertebral bodies in terms of building stronger vertebral bodies, but it's not very good for your knee joints. If I look at cardiovascular exercise, it may be good for your heart, but not for everything. If I look at, you know, low impact or yoga, it may be very good for certain things, but not for others. So it's always a bit more complex than we'd like to look at it and think it is. It's not magic bullet. It's not sort of a naive, this is wonderful, it does everything. No, it's a little more to it than that usually. Same with diet.
And one of the things I especially like about your approach, not only is it holistic, but it emphasizes moderation. Using the physical fitness as an example, people who pursue extreme sports or are, you know, exercising several hours a day or something, it's usually doing more harm than good.
Sometimes we get so caught up in one little thing that we ruin our lives. If your entire life is devoted to extreme exercise to get healthy, maybe you're forgetting to smell the flowers. Maybe you're forgetting to have a chocolate mousse. Again, back to Paleolithic diet. You know, the point of eating is not just to be healthy. If I could prove to you that you would live forever by living in the basement in the dark and eating sawdust, most of us would shrug our shoulders and have no interest. There is a quality of life that you want too. And I think that it helps to know that exercise should not just be to get healthy, but to enjoy the exercise.
And with the work I do, I come at that from, you have to start with a sense of purpose. And when you've got a clear sense of purpose, then the other things fall into line in terms of perspective. But without it, you end up checking your blood pressure too much.
Michael, that's so true of people's lives in general. I mean, how many people you know who thought that what they wanted to do is to get rich and then they're not happy, or they wanted to be famous and they're not happy? It's difficult for any of us to know what we really want in life. But having that sense of purpose, understanding what it is you're really trying to get, some people really do want just money. Some people want to have a nice family. Some people want to have a sense of being worth it to their neighbors. Some people want to help people. If you understand what really it is you want as a purpose in life, you're much more apt to be able to get it. I think that's true here. If you understand what it is you're really looking for, is it just that I want to be stronger than everyone else? Is it just that I want health? Is it that I want low stress? What is it that I'm looking for in my life? Why am I doing this? You're much more likely to be able to attain it.
And then the other tricky part is there's so much change in our lives and in our culture that you have to constantly tweak or sometimes do major overhauls to your sense of purpose.
Yes, you're right. The environment changes. Your goals can change. You're not just somebody who wants something. You're somebody who is wanting something, and that wanting changes. You have to decide where it is you're going. And the place I most clearly see that is some young person, and what they want to do is, again, become happy in their career. And maybe that goal changes as they get older, and what they want is grandchildren. Whatever that change is, those changes occur, and you're right, you need to keep your eyes open and ask, who am I today? What am I trying to be tomorrow?
We'll get back to Dr. Fossil in a moment. Dr. Fossil and I talked about the importance of having a sense of purpose and enjoying life. Historically, psychologists have focused on fixing what's wrong. From almost 40 years of clinical experience, I'm very good at fixing problems, but what I enjoy most doing is helping people be clear about their purpose and achieve a more successful, more fulfilling life. You don't even have to leave home. My personal coaching by phone can help you with romantic goals, professional goals, career goals, and personal goals. Just as athletes use coaches to achieve their full potential, my coaching can help you achieve your full potential and have a more fulfilling life. If you have specific issues or are interested in life makeover coaching to develop a more comprehensive plan for your life, give me a call and I'll see if I can get you on my coaching schedule. The phone number is on all my websites, and further information about my coaching is at drbricky.com. That's drbricky.com. And now back to Dr. Fossil. Back on physical fitness, again, you have a holistic approach. You resistance training, you need some relaxation, maybe some yoga or some stretching, you need to warm up. The one thing that was a little different than a lot of recommendations is you weren't real big on aerobic training, but instead preferred interval training.
Again, I think that's more David's recommendations than Greta's, actually. There has been a shift in a lot of people's thoughts about the importance of that. Again, some of these things are fads and fashions. As I said, you know, sugar being nature's food 100 years ago. So I would be wary of that, particularly within diets. The last 10 or 20 years, the diet fashions and fads have just gone all over. But in exercise as well. And partly it's a matter of what is it you're really trying to attain, and partly it's a matter of what works. And it is also a matter of being careful what you're doing just because it's in fashion and what really attains the goal you're looking for. That is so hard to tease out sometimes. So for whatever reason, you're right. The recommendations that we have are, I think, a little more in line with the way things are shifting, but that doesn't prove they're right either. It's just our best guess so far.
Well, I do see a change in the last 10, 15 years that things like physical fitness is getting a lot more good research behind it rather than just somebody's theory.
Right.
So with the interval training, which is basically do an all-out sprint as opposed to half an hour on the treadmill, there's more physiological data saying here's the effect it has on your body and why people are recommending it.
You know, I'm thinking about something that you reminded me of. We were talking about this a couple of minutes ago. The reason you do these things, too. If I every day spent 4 hours on a treadmill and all I did was stare at a wall and I'm bored, I may be healthier, but I've also lost 4 hours of my life. There was a funny calculation someone did a few years ago, back probably 20 years ago now, where they were calculating the amount of time that you lost buckling your seatbelt on the average versus the amount of risk of actually having a fatal accident. Again, I think it was meant to be humorous, but what they were pointing out was that you actually lost time over your life by buckling your seatbelt. Again, I don't think that the conclusion was right, but the point they were making was a good one, which is what we should be asking ourselves is, you know, what am I getting out of this? Am I getting health, but I'm also losing 4 hours being bored? Or if I'm eating food that I think is healthy, but I don't like, have I lost quality of life? Those things are still critical, and I think we need to keep our eye on that ball when we're talking about interval training, when we're talking about yoga. Are these things really contributing as a whole, holistically, again, to my life? Or are they just something I'm doing because I somehow feel that I'm a Puritan and I have to do that even though I hate it? You're losing something if you're doing that.
So the question should be, with physical fitness, for example, here are some outcomes that I would like to have, not that I have to have, and how can I achieve these in the most enjoyable, rewarding way possible?
Yes. I'm reminded of the data on obesity that suggested that, at various points, it's been suggested that each of us has set point, and if you spend your whole life trying to go from 200 pounds down to 140 pounds, but you become sicker or less happy because you do that, what's the point of doing it? And again, I'm not saying that most people aren't obese or a little overweight, most of us are, but you have to temper that with an understanding of why you're doing this and the overall benefit to you, whether it's exercise, diet, or anything else. Why are you doing this?
I want to shift gears to a question that may dawn on people, namely, if we get people living so much longer, do we have to be concerned about overpopulation?
Well, I think we do. Let me make a general point right away, which is that everything we're talking about is a benefit to the individual. The social benefit is not so clear. That is, if you were able to give me a lifespan of 500 years with absolute health, happiness, enjoyment, excellent. But what does that do to society in general? Different question. I'm not saying it's bad for it, but it's an open question. What does it do to cost of living? What does it do to the risk of environmental damage? What does it do to crowding? What does it do to stress? Good question. In fact, there's a discussion that I'm going to be having with what used to be called zero population growth at a conference in April in Boston. That's a good question. I don't see how you can argue that it's going to decrease population. It certainly ought to increase it. In fact, there's something that for years has been called Fossil's Rule of Thumb, and it's pretty simple, which is that the increase in the mean lifespan equates to the increase in overall population. So if I double the mean lifespan, I probably double the population. Well, it turns out there are about another 12 or so variables, a dozen or so variables. But roughly speaking, that's accurate. So if I increase the average lifespan from 78 to 150, what does that do to the population that's involved? It turns out it's not the whole world, of course, because some people die young. Some populations in the world still don't have access to any sort of medical care, let alone the sort of thing we're talking about. Even though the cost is likely to be low, there's still going to be some disparities. I mean, we're probably looking at hundreds of dollars, not thousands, certainly not hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're looking at a low cost for increasing lifespan, but still, some people don't have $100. So for whatever reason, the population will go up. But let me put this in another perspective. One, let me point out that people most worried about population have a very easy answer to that, which is to remove themselves from it. No one's willing to do that. I mean, if I want to lower human population on this planet, I could take myself out of it. And that's not what I meant. Usually what we're more interested in is lower the birth rate, which is a different matter. The second thing is a story that occurred now back about 15 years. When my first book came out, somebody came in to interview one of my older patients. This was an 84-year-old woman with pneumonia, as I recall her. And the reporter said to her, listen, if we had, Dr. Fossil had a pill that reversed aging, would you take it? And she said, no, I'd let nature take its course. And I said to her, I notice you have a big scar on your chest. What's that? She said, that's a scar from quadruple bypass. I said, I notice your knuckles are swollen. Why is that? She said, oh, you know what that is. That's my arthritis. It's terrible, and the Motrin doesn't help anymore. And I said, and tell me, why are you here in the hospital to see me today? She said, well, it's because I'm here in pneumonia, and I think I need to be, oh, wait a minute, I see what you're driving at. I'll take the pill. If what you're talking about is reversing human aging, some of us would say, well, let's let nature take its course. But if what I'm talking about is Alzheimer's disease and aching knees and inability to control my urine and the fact that I, you know, I can't get across the room without being short of breath, that's different. That we'd like to cure. That is what we're talking about. We're not talking about reversing human aging. We're talking about the things that bother us in life. Not knowing where we put the keys, progressing to not knowing the name of our grandchildren, progressing to not being able to feed ourselves. That's different. That we'd like to avoid. And when you're trying to compare that sort of human suffering to human population growth, for most of us as individuals, it's a hands-down choice. I don't want Alzheimer's. I don't want a heart attack. I don't want my wife to die. I don't want my children to suffer. That's a different matter. So I'm not saying we need to lose sight of population growth or stress to the ecology of the planet. Not at all. I'm just recognizing what human beings do. Very few human beings are going to say, well, you know what? I'll let myself die because it's better for the planet. They prefer someone else did that. That's sort of human nature. So I think we need to keep an eye on the risks involved, societal risks, the ecological risks, the cultural risks. I mean, what happens to our culture as a whole when this sort of shift occurs? But I think we need to recognize this is not a controllable thing, nor should it be. We're talking about getting rid of human suffering, not extending the human lifespan. No, this is personal.
The analogy I like to use is becoming Energizer bunnies on alkaline batteries, because alkaline batteries not only last longer, but when they die rather suddenly rather than this gradual decline.
You're right. That's about what will happen, too.
And if people start living to 150, we have to have a big shift where you don't start playing golf 5 days a week at age 65.
Mm-hmm. You're right. If I'm 65 and I'm thinking about life in the future, I tend to think about retirement, and there is a certain sense of limitation. But if I could live another 200 years and I don't like my job, then it becomes a different matter. It's not a matter of, well, I better finish the last 3 years for retirement. You begin to think, you know what? Maybe I'll go back and get a degree in architecture. Maybe I'll go get that MBA. Maybe I'll switch and start a florist shop. That sort of thing is less likely to happen to the 65 and 70-year-old crowd now than I wish it did. But it doesn't happen as often as it does to the 20 and 30-year-old group who can say to themselves, I'll switch my life. If we live longer, I think it gives us more opportunities.
And especially if your mind is still sharp, which if we get telomeres helping us out with that, we're more likely to have sharp minds at 80, 100, 120, and so on.
And in fact, this is a social benefit. In at least two senses. One is, one of the worries that people come up with when you talk about extending the lifespan is they think, my God, think of the cost of supporting all those retired people. To the contrary, what makes you think they're retired? Why should they retire when they have the health and physiology of a 30-year-old? Why are they retiring? They should be out still doing things. One, making a living, but two, enjoying themselves. And then most people who retire, and if they really mean that, find it a boring sort of thing to do. They often volunteer or come back to another career if they've got the health to do it. And they do. There's no reason people should retire at 150 if they're so active and enjoying a career they want to do. The other thing is that currently what we do is we vary experience and intelligence every day. We take people with tremendous career knowledge, and they die. We bury them. Well, instead of getting rid of those people, they'll still be there. We'll have people who have 70 years of business experience, you know, 100 years of experience with dealing with children, the knowledge of medicine or law or politics or God knows what, for better or for worse, that's extensive. So I think that in a general way, this is actually a good thing for our culture. We'll have a more efficient culture if we don't have people who are in some sense contributing less than they used to the economy, and we won't be wasting people. We'll have people's knowledge and experience still available to us. That's a good thing.
And when parents don't have time to do all the parenting, not only might we have grandparents step up to help out, but great-grandparents and great-great and great-great-great-grandparents, mm-hmm. who have more interest and more to share than a parent who's too busy.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true. So we could have extended families that are healthy and extended in some ways. Of course, it brings up the sort of amusing, apocryphal story of the worst competition you've got for a date on Saturday night is your great-great-great-great something or other, you know. Could happen. Yeah, could happen.
Dr. Fossil, it's delightful talking with you again. Dr. Fossil is the principal author of The Immortality Edge. The website is michaelfossil.com. And The Immortality Edge is very readable, and it's very oriented to your best understanding of what we can do now to help us live longer and healthier and help out our telomeres. Dr. Fossil, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Michael. Let's do this again sometime, if not in the next couple of years, in the next 500 years.
I'd love to. Commentary. Telomeres appear to be a major key to health and longevity. Telomere research has been slowly but surely advancing and closing in on practical, affordable interventions to extend telomere length, which appears to enhance health and longevity. Stay tuned. In the meantime, The Immortality Edge both helps us understand telomeres and explains what we can do now to help our telomeres. As was evident in the interview with Dr. Fossil, he sticks close to the data and is careful not to assume too much or assume that what we believe to be true now will turn out to be true 10 years from now. He also is very concerned about psychological aspects of living, including balance, purpose, and enjoying life. He wrote the section of the book on telomeres and efforts to develop pills and other interventions that will help. His co-authors address diet, exercise, and supplements. Their recommendations for supplements try to tie each supplement to how the supplement affects telomeres. Their recommendations for exercise and nutrition, however, are a little more speculative about the ties to telomeres. For nutrition, they recommend a Paleolithic diet, that is, mimicking the eating habits of our hunter-gatherer ancestors. That diet calls for little or no grains or dairy. It's a very carnivorous diet. Of course, they specify free-range organic meats that not everybody can afford. And the diet can be modified for vegetarians, but they obviously believe that a carnivorous diet is preferable. In sum, it's time to start paying attention to taking care of our telomeres. You are listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. Information on my books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, my anti-aging hypnosis CDs, personal coaching, and keynote and seminar services are at notaging.com or drbricky.com. That's drbricky.com. I'd love to hear your comments and suggestions. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.